Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for tuning in to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, July 16th. The new school year begins in just a few weeks with all the headlines about federal cuts. What should families know about how their children could be affected? And a word of warning about facing a cliff. The new rules to combat waste in the food subsidy SNAP program, formerly known as the food stamps program, comes with stiff penalties. We learn more about impacts to our healthcare system with the impending loss of Medicaid dollars. We meet a grumpy non-native bird with a territorial call on this week's Manu Minute. And a local chef eats his roots all the way to a regional Emmy. We hear about his journey to showcase his blended cultures in his cooking. This is A Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Public school teachers return to the classroom for the new school year in exactly 2 weeks. Students are soon to follow. We talked to the Deputy Superintendent of Schools, Tammy Oyatomari Chun, this morning about what families need to know about a freeze on federal funds and how that may translate to the classrooms, school lunches, and after-school programs.
So in March, Congress passed the continuing resolution that allowed for this year's federal budget that meant that the government wouldn't shut down because they had a budget. As part of that process, the Congress appropriated funds for education programs that included level funding, meaning the same level of funds for this year as last year, for major programs that support the federal funds to Hawaii's public schools. Hawaii public schools, like schools around the country, receive a lot of the federal funds through formula, meaning that based on our population, we get a certain amount of money. So since March, we have been anticipating receiving a similar level of funding as prior years for all of our formula-funded education programs. We just found out at the end of June that the U.S. Department of Education is not releasing funds for six different programs. This is happening across the nation, not just Hawaii. And those six programs combined represent about $33 million of support for our schools and students in the state. So these are funds that we had been counting on because Congress had appropriated the money. States across the country were surprised that the money was going to be withheld, especially so close to the start of the school year.
And then that money, we're reading funds after school programs, and I think that's probably a concern. When families hear that, they're like, oh, what does that mean? Is A-plus affected? So what can you tell us? Are those programs run out of those six programs that are being frozen?
So there's six different programs. They serve a variety of different purposes. The one that's getting the most attention right now is called the 21st Century Community Learning Centers Program that provides contracts to providers for out-of-school time. The most visible part of those programs are our after-school programs provided, say, by after-school all-stars. These are not our A-plus programs. So these programs will often fund, say, middle school after-school programs. A-plus is a totally separate program that's not affected by this withholding of federal funds.
Okay, I was wondering if A-plus then is also funded through the general fund, since it is state subsidized. It wasn't real clear, and parents are probably wondering, you know, they hear after-school programs and are worried that they might have to find some accommodation as the school is about to start.
So let me talk about them individually, okay. Just for clarification. So A-plus is a state program. There are federal funds, but the federal funds associated with that program are through TANF from the Department of Human Services to support the tuition or fees for low-income students. So it is not funded through federal funds as an after-school program per se. So A-plus will continue to run for the start of the school year.
Okay. I think that's a big assurance that parents, I think, were hoping to hear as they prepare for the new school year.
On the 21st Century Community Learning Centers program, those programs are going to be able to begin the year as planned. So we are using what's called carryover funds, meaning funds that were not spent from last year's grant, to be able to start the school year and be able to provide those services. So families can be assured that any after-school programs that had been planned and funded through the 21st Century Community Learning Centers program, federally funded, will be able to start the school year.
And will teachers be affected in any way, because they're headed back to the classroom in a couple of weeks to prepare for the children to come through the doors?
So at this time, Hawaii was part of a lawsuit against the federal government to release these funds that were congressionally appropriated. We were a part of 24 states that filed the lawsuit. So if we are successful in the courts, the U.S. Department of Education would release the funds, so they would just be delayed in its receipt. So we are organizing ourselves with the expectation that the courts will compel the federal government to send us the funds that are already allocated to us. So at this time, we are organizing ourselves to make sure that the priority activities, the personnel, the programs for students that were already planned will be able to start the school year. In the meantime, we're making contingency plans to look at how we would be able to continue to support the critical services on an ongoing basis in the event that the funds are very delayed or not received.
And what about on the school lunch front? What are we looking at for this new academic year?
For our school meals program, there's no direct impacts at this time from changes with the federal government. This U.S. Department of Agriculture is continuing to provide the reimbursement for our school meals for eligible students. We have a lot of concerns, however, about what we're hearing could be impacts on our student meals program, but so far, the program continues to be funded as it has in the past. But we're monitoring a lot of potential actions that could be taken by Congress or U.S. Department of Agriculture that would impact our student meals program.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll get enough notice so that if you have to go to Plan B, that you can do that, because running a statewide school district is challenging because you've got different schools doing the cooking and rolling out those meals. So you got to make sure that we can get the food on the food trays.
Absolutely. It's a priority that our students are fed. It's a partnership that we also have with the legislature around making sure that a school meal provides food security for students who need it. The legislature passed Senate Bill 1300 this year that provided increased the support for our students who need financial assistance in getting a school meal. So the bill had two parts. The first part is that for this coming school year, 25-26, that starts in a few weeks, our students who were previously eligible for reduced lunch, so they paid, say, 40 cents for their meal, they would now be able to receive that meal for free. The state is going to cover the cost of what the family used to pay for our students who were eligible. The second part of the bill also would provide support for free meals for students who are up to 300% of poverty, what we would consider ALICE, Asset Limited Income Constrained Employed, so our working poor families, so they would be eligible for a free state-subsidized meal in the following school year, which is 26-27.
Okay, lots of moving parts as we try and prepare to get the students and the teachers back in the classroom. Anything else that you think would be important to underscore?
We're working with our congressional delegation, the Attorney General's office, and the Governor's office to advocate for release of the funds so that we can continue with plans. Like you mentioned, it's difficult when the federal government and U.S. Department of Education makes a quick move by withholding funds that Congress appropriated so close to the start of the school year. So I think states across the country were caught off guard that we received such late notice that the funds wouldn't be released on the usual schedule, because school is starting not just for us, but for schools across the country over the next month.
That was Tammy Oyotomari Chun, Deputy School Superintendent of Public Schools, talking to us about how education officials are preparing for the return to the classroom by thousands of students in just a few weeks. She tells us that right now the Hawaii DOE is not directly impacted by the court wrangling over the dismantling of the U.S. Department of Education. This week, State Attorney General Ann Lopez expressed disappointment that the U.S. Supreme Court is allowing the president to lay off staff, even though a hearing on the merits of the case have not yet been heard.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
Today on The Daily. During a congressional hearing on Tuesday, Republican lawmakers once again accused university leaders of failing to do enough to combat anti-Semitism on their campuses, a claim that the university officials strongly rejected. I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30, following Marketplace.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
The Tax Foundation of Hawaii is cautioning about falling off a fiscal cliff. Recently, the federal government fined Hawaii $11 million because of a 20% error rate in the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, formerly known as food stamps. Those errors were mostly overpayments, but the details in the president's big, beautiful bill contains fine print that levies some even stiffer penalties with no wiggle room if the error rate in spending exceeds the cap. We talked to Tom Yamachika of the Hawaii Tax Foundation this morning about his concerns.
There are federal rules regarding when you can pay out and when you can't pay out SNAP benefits, and then SNAP, of course, referring to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is a lifeline for many people both here and on the mainland. The problem that we had in 2022 and 2023 fiscal years was that we had error rates of more than 20%. So the feds came and hit us with fines of $11 million, but they gave us a break. They said, look, if you spend half of that toward new technology, then maybe we'll let you slide on the other $5.5 million. The Department of Human Services went to the legislature and they got an emergency appropriation for the $5.5 million, and they're glad they dodged the bullet. But the problem now is that under the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the stakes get a lot higher because starting in 2027, states are going to be asked to pick up part of the cost of these food allowances that are given to people under SNAP if they have an error rate of more than 6%. Now, we got fined for going over 20% for 2 years in a row, and then we brought it down to 6.68 in 2024. That's still over 6. And if you go over 6, you got to submit 5%, or you have to give the federal government 5%, which we estimate is going to be $32 million. So that's almost three times the fine that we got slapped with for going over 20%. And there's no chance for waiver of half of that like we had this year. So the risk is very high. And it doesn't stop there. If the error rate is more than 8%, then you get double the pleasure. So instead of $36 million, we're going to have to kick in at $73 million. And if you go over 10%, then it's 15% that we have to kick in. So what is that, 100, 105 million?
I hope that they can hurry up and put whatever software they need, the upgrades to our computer system in order to track what's going in and what's going out, because quite honestly, that's wasteful, right? If our error rate, if we had overpayments or underpayments, that's not a good way to handle taxpayers' money.
Oh, absolutely. And it's, I think, much easier for us to invest in like a few more people or additional training. What's that going to cost? Maybe $500,000, $1 million? Sure beats 100.
Yeah, but it's 2025. And if 2027 is when this kicks in, I sure hope that we can get the upgrades in place before that happens.
It's important to realize that we got to start thinking about this now, because in 2027, when the law kicks in, the feds will give us a choice to use the 2026 error rate or the 2025 error rate. And so we just finished fiscal year 2025. So that part's already locked in stone, and we got to get our act together basically next year.
Or like you say, we're going to fall off a cliff.
That's right. The problem with that is, there is no consolation prize if you go like 6.01%, right? If you're 6% or over, boom, it's 30 million.
Yeah,
5.99, you avoid the cost entirely.
Yeah, no wiggle room, just a big stick.
That's right. It's a very big stick.
Yeah, or a hammer, however you want to put it. But that's a reality that we're facing under this big, beautiful bill. It's big and bad. It could be very bad.
Yeah, there's... With the size of that bill, it's two reams of paper. There's a lot of stuff in it.
800 pages, I think, or something like that was what Representative Case said.
Yeah. There's stuff in it to like, maybe, and stuff in it to hate. And there's all kinds of different treats and different traps. The full impact is probably not going to be understood for a little while, but we got to start getting our act together.
So you're simply flagging it for our policymakers, serious ramifications if we don't get it right.
That's right.
Anything else that you think would be important to look at just from a tax perspective?
I just wanted to also mention that a 6% error rate is not unattainable for us. We've done that in 2017 and 2018. We went a little bit over 6 in 2019, and we got 6.68 in 2024. We just need to go back to the fundamentals, to what we were doing in the mid-2010s. And I think we'll be okay, but we can't be complacent. We need to really make those investments and take a look at our training and how we're processing these federal claims.
Just run a tighter ship.
You've got to run a tighter ship.
Yeah. But anything else on that big bill and tax consequences, pluses or minuses?
Yeah, there are lots of things in the tax code to look at. We're going to be probably examining a lot of them in seminars and presentations that I and others are going to be making throughout the state.
Okay, you just have to get through reading the bill and figuring out what passed and what didn't, or what got changed.
And what's permanent and what's temporary. There's a lot of temporary stuff. There's a lot of phase-outs. What's touted, what's in the media as a tax benefit might not be beneficial for you. For example, no tax on tips, that I think phases out. There's a limit of 25,000, I believe, and then it phases out.
Yeah, well, it grabs the headlines when you look. It doesn't last very long, and it may not be as impactful as people may think.
Yeah, just like myself, I broke down and bought a Tesla a couple of years ago, lured by the prospect of getting a nice fat electric vehicle credit. And then when I did my taxes for the year I bought the car, I found out, oh, you're a little bit over the income limit, so no credit.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wanted to throw something.
I feel your pain. All right. Anything else?
No, I think, like I said, the full impact of the bill is going to be unfolding, and then you can take a look at the different issues that come up.
Okay. And we'll be holding forums to discuss this, to have a conversation in a pointed way.
Yeah. I know I and a couple of other tax attorneys are going to get some presentations together. And we did the same thing when the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act came out. And we're going to be doing something similar in the days and weeks ahead.
Okay. All right. We'll look forward to it. But thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you, Catherine.
And that was Tom Yamachika of the Tax Foundation of Hawaii warning about the fine print in President Donald Trump's spending bill that was just signed into law. We continue on the topic of local impacts to President Trump's big, beautiful bill. You know, there have been lots of hand-wringing over expected cuts to the Medicaid program. Roughly one-third of Hawaii residents currently receive benefits under the program. Today, we take a look at the impact to our health care facilities. We have government reporter Ashley Mizua joining us in studio today. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, so Trump's mega bill, or President Trump's mega bill, or, you know, what we're going to be calling from now on, I think, H.R. 1, will change healthcare access in kind of three main ways in the coming years. You just need to know this to kind of set up what these impacts are going to be. First is adding work requirements for Medicaid eligibility. Another is increasing the paperwork filing requirements for Medicaid eligibility from once to now twice a year. And the third is restricting automatic re-enrollment for Obamacare, and then limiting subsidies for enrollees, which will likely mean higher insurance premiums for people who are on Obamacare. Most of these are not going into place until 2027, although the subsidies on Obamacare will be largely expiring in 2026. And they say that premiums are expected to rise on average about 75%. Next year. So rough estimates by the Hawaii Healthcare Association show that in Hawaii, about 10,000 people on Obamacare and about 30,000 on Medicaid could lose their coverage due to the changes. And that would basically double the amount of uninsured people in the state, which is currently just 3% of the population. Hawaii actually has one of the lowest amount of uninsured people in the country. Hawaii Healthcare Association President Hilton Rathel says that could have really significant impacts to the state's hospitals because uninsured people put off seeking care until it's an emergency.
If you've got 40-plus thousand individuals in the state of Hawaii who no longer have insurance, they become uninsured. And what we do know is that people who are uninsured, they tend to seek care less often because they do not have insurance. By definition, they're low-income individuals. There's a good chance they won't have the money to pay for their health care. So if they do get sick, they may put off seeing a doctor. If they get really sick, they may end up going to an emergency room. And hospitals, by law, federal law, are required to see any patient that shows up in their hospital and stabilize them under the entire rule, a federal rule. So the hospital has to take care of them, but they may not have insurance, which means that the hospital doesn't get paid for taking care of these individuals, whether they're in the emergency room or if they end up having to be admitted.
And Hawaii Medical Association President Dr. Elizabeth Ignacio says, you know, neighbor islands and rural hospitals are likely to be hit hardest.
Those Medicaid dollars are extremely important to neighbor island hospitals. We don't want to see any of our critical access hospitals close, but a lot of them have already been running in the red, and this will surely be extremely difficult for them to continue all of their services in the face of these cuts. The areas that will suffer are the ones in the small communities, the care that happens in the small communities, because our physicians and our healthcare workforce will only be able to sustain their practice in a more populated area.
And of course, that means that people who live in the rural areas will need to travel to more populated areas, meaning sometimes even Oahu, which is already an issue, you know, when it comes to transporting from neighbor islands to get the care they need on Oahu. There is a $50 billion rural health fund in H.R. 1 that could help diminish some of the impacts to hospitals, but the state won't really know how exactly the funds can be used until the Federal Department of Health and Human Services comes out with its rules. We do know that half of that amount will be distributed evenly among the states with approved applications, and then the other half is going to be determined by Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which is within HHS. It's estimated that the $50 billion would replace only about a third of the lost Medicaid funding in rural areas. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey put together a list of rural hospitals most in jeopardy because they're in the top 10% of Medicaid providers in the area or have had 3 years of negative margins. Six hospitals in that list were identified in Hawaii, all on neighbor islands. Yeah. They include Molokai General Hospital and Lanai Community Hospital. But Rathel says, you know, many rural hospitals belong to the Hawaii Health Systems Corporation, which is already subsidized by the state. But if there are a lot of people losing coverage and a lot of these hospitals feel those impacts, the state will have to put up more money.
That comes from tax dollars. So that's a further burden that goes on the state. Now, we're very fortunate in Hawaii that we do have this Hawaii Health Systems Corporation. And we are very fortunate the legislature does support those. But if the legislature is putting more money into the HHSC system, then there's less money available for education, there's less money available for roads, for harbors, all the other things that we need to keep Hawaii intact.
And, you know, when it comes to that $50 billion rural health fund, it's important to note that that runs out after the first couple of years, but these Medicaid cuts will be going on in perpetuity, essentially. So some rural clinics, like Wainaiko's Comprehensive Health Center out on West Oahu, where 2/3 of their patients are on Medicaid, have already started preparing for some of these cuts, although many of them are not coming down again until 2027, 2028. Its president, Rich Bettini, says they are working on digital training to help people fulfill the work required to be eligible for Medicaid, and the hope is that, you know, if they have evidence in place to show that the state is trying to comply with these changes, they may be given an extension. Another idea that they've had at Wainaiko's Comprehensive Health Center has been getting EMT training out in Waianae, as there is an EMT shortage, you know, island-wide, and Wainaiko's Comprehensive Health Center wants more ambulance services, so they're hoping to bring more job training to the Waianae coast so that people don't have to drive into town for that education, which can be a huge barrier.
Yeah, that's a good
people.
Idea.
Yeah. And they said they have been like having some conversations with Mayor Blangiardi about this. And they're also working on raising funds to support job training, as Wainaiko's Comprehensive Health Center is also one of the largest employers in the area. Here's Bettini.
There's a lot of people out there that are going to be gaining a lot of benefit from these tax cuts. They would make wonderful donors to a new foundation that would help us develop funds to support workforce training.
And I wanted to add, too, that, you know, Wainaiko's Comprehensive Health Center says that they are very financially stable, and they've actually had a lot of experience in doing job training already. They have a dental program, and so they're saying, you know, there's going to be at present, no changes to their ability to serve their community, and that people shouldn't, you know, panic or delay visits or things like that. They really are encouraging people to continue to come in and get the services that they need. The State Department of Human Services has also encouraged people to do the same thing, continue to go to the doctor, as there aren't any immediate changes to health coverage, but they're really cautioning people to watch out for any communication about their health coverage and to respond when they're asked to respond. I think one of the issues with the extra amounts of eligibility renewal periods has been that it's already difficult oftentimes for DHS to get in touch with people to renew their coverage, because many people who are on Medicaid don't really have super stable housing all the time, or they're moving and they don't change their address or contact information.
Yeah.
So just keep in mind that in the coming years, especially as you're moving around, to keep in touch with them and give them all your contact information.
Right, because if you don't, you could get cut from the rolls and lose your coverage. Yeah, it's... And then it's a downward spiral. That's not good.
Right, exactly.
And it's a shame, because I know there's been lots of efforts going toward reducing the number of, you know, let's say like homeless people that end up in the ER, right? You don't want to clog the ER, you know, so they're
right.
Really making a concerted effort to try and treat people where they need it and not run to the ER.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that for a lot of these doctors, they're really encouraging people and to not, like, I think the big emphasis right now is there's a lot of talk about people losing health insurance in the coming years, but these are not happening for several years. And so to really not panic and delay your doctor visits because you're concerned, you should use your health insurance that you have and go to the doctor when you need
right.
to.
Stay healthy.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ashley. We've been hearing from HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mazua, about the impacts of federal Medicaid cuts to hospital systems here in Hawaii.
For many women who menstruate, period blood is an inconvenience you just deal with and move on. But it turns out that blood may unlock health secrets way beyond the female reproductive system.
This idea that you can diagnose an illness or a disorder using menstrual blood is really cool and probably should have happened a really long time ago.
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following The World.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We are trekking across lava fields for today's backyard quiz. As we await episode 29 of Kilauea's eruption, field engineers at the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory are busy maintaining nearly 150 monitoring instruments above and below the volcano's surface. To do this, they have to walk through fields of what's called tephra around Kilauea summit. And tephra is essentially particles and material erupted from volcanoes. It can include pumice stone, Pele's hair, and volcanic ash. And these field scientists wear special equipment to help them traverse the areas near the ongoing eruption. For their faces, the scientists strap on respirators, but they also make use of an interesting piece of equipment for their feet. Take a listen to a group of field engineers crossing a field of pumice stone. For today's quiz, can you tell us the type of special footwear that the researchers are wearing? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NereidHawaii.com.
Today's Mono Minute spotlights a bird that stretches out over about 5 inches in length, beak to tail, and it's small enough to sit comfortably in the palm of your hand. But don't underestimate this little bird. Its songs pack a punch. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to the red-billed Leothrix.
Red-billed Leothrix are one of the prettiest non-native birds that live in Hawaii. While their body feathers are mostly grayish-green, both males and females have a golden-yellow throat, red, orange, and yellow stripes on their wings, and, as their name implies, bright red bills. Leothrix are native to Southeast Asia and southern China and were introduced first to the island of Kauai as cage birds in the early 1900s. By the 1920s, they are one of the most common birds in the lowland forests of Kauai, and on most of the other main Hawaiian islands a few decades after that. Strangely, they seem to have gone extinct on Kauai, even though they're still common on most of the other islands and are resistant to mosquito-transmitted diseases like avian malaria that are causing sharp declines in our native bird species. Even though Leothrix spend most of their time foraging within just a few meters of the forest floor, they can be very hard to find because they're usually in dense shrubs and small trees. Because of this, they're more often heard than seen. They have three main kinds of vocalizations. The first has a variety of notes and is sung by males during breeding season to attract females. A second song is much simpler and is sung by both sexes throughout the year. The third is more of an aggressive, scolding chatter call that's directed at humans or other intruders when they get too close. It sounds a bit like a harsh rattle. If you hear that last sound, you know an angry Leothrix is nearby. Leothrix are common in lowland forests dominated by non-native trees and in high-elevation forests where the trees and shrubs are almost all native. Because they're such active fruit eaters, Leothrix are major dispersers of a variety of seeds, including those from native plants that no longer have other birds to disperse their fruits. Unfortunately, though, Leothrix are also one of the major dispersers of invasive plant seeds, such as Clydemia, Myconia, and strawberry guava, into the remaining native forests of Hawaii. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, exploring Hawaii Island with visitors and kama'aina for more than 30 years. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
Hawaii Public Radio is here for you and with you through the magic of discovery.
Brian Eno with the song called The Big Ship. I'm Jeff Long. You are listening to Bridging the Gap. My friend Taylor turned me on to that song, and I remember running on those hot Waianae mornings listening to this song. I'm just feeling like I could just handle anything.
Local music shows on HPR are always brought to you with a personal touch.
So I figured this is too good to pass up, so I'm sharing it with you today on Brazilian Experience on HPR One, and I'm your host, Sandy Tsukiyama.
Support music discovery on Hawaii Public Radio. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Chef Ippi Iona is a Big Island chef who's no stranger to the camera. He made waves at 23 when he was the youngest finalist on the TV show Food Network Star. And that was more than a decade ago. These days, he's the host of the docuseries Eating Our Roots, which aired on Hawaii News Now. The show took home a regional Emmy at the Northern California Area Awards in June for editing. Chef Ippi's second cookbook, Growing Up Hapa in Hawaii, will be released in September. Iona spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about getting comfortable in front of the camera and staying true to his roots.
I started actually with TV on a show called Next Food Network Star, and I was 23 at the time, and that was on Food Network, and that was basically, if you win, you get your own cooking show, you know, like on Food Network. And I mean, I had long, like, hair down to here, super curly, like it was a whole different time, no kids. Like, that competition was supposed to be to have our own show. So I think the show that I had originally planned on there was called Ippi's Pacific Voyage.
Aloha kako. Hello and welcome. My name is Ippi, and I want to take you on an epic journey to a place with white sands, crystal blue ocean, taro patches, and salt mines. To a place where food is more than just three meals a day, but a part of who you are, your culture, and your family. So sit back, grab a tropical drink, and join me in my paradise, Hawaii, as I take you on Ippi's Voyage to Paradise.
The problem was, is I wanted to do a show like Eating Our Roots, and Food Network was very much against it and wanting to do more of a show like, you know, like a cooking show, like something that's in the kitchen, that being said, it was never, eating our roots wasn't fully conceptualized until me and Kobe got together. The first thing we actually came up with was the pitch. Like, it's the trailer for the show. We have a little trailer that we started the whole thing with. And that's the first thing that I wrote and sent it to Kobe. And like that first night that we kind of came up with the whole idea, she's like, oh, I love it. This is so perfect. And it ended up working out. It's like everything that we both wanted in a show and that we both wanted to do was right here. And we were able to do it together. So yeah, it ended up working out perfect.
What do you think your training and your background as competing as a chef on some of these Food Network shows taught you about being a chef in front of the camera? Because that's a little bit different than running a restaurant, having people experience your food by eating it. It's a very visual medium, and you also have to talk in a way that you might not otherwise be used to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, camera cooking is totally different. I was just telling someone yesterday, it's like sports, you know, it's like you have to practice to get good at it. It's a different type of muscles that you use compared to most chefs. We're planners. Like, we like controlled chaos, and that happens in the kitchen, but we're planners. You have to plan a menu. You have to order. You have to put a prep list together, your mise en place. Like, it's key to make a successful restaurant. So when you get thrown into something that's like, okay, you have no time to plan. You have no, just get it done. You know, your station is a mess. Like, it takes a certain type of, you know, muscle memory to do that. So that's something I noticed with competition cooking. And I always tell everybody, the camera has no soul. The camera's like a black void. When you talk to somebody else, you can vibe off of their energy. When you talk to the camera, you can't. So you have to be like multiple notches above what you would normally be. And I noticed myself when I was trying to do that, irritating myself. And I was like, you're acting like a dork. What are you doing right now? You know? But then when you watch it on camera, you're like, wow, it sucks so much energy out from you that even though you're all the way up here on camera, you just seem normal. You know, it's an odd thing how the camera works. So that's something that is very, very different from what I normally do.
What of any of those skills do you think helped you the most in hosting Eating Our Roots and doing justice to the types of stories you were trying to tell?
I think one, being comfortable. Like, you can see when somebody's uncomfortable on camera, and you can see when someone's comfortable on camera. It's very obvious. So being comfortable on camera was a big deal, because on Eating Our Roots, we have a lot of people, they're farmers and ranchers and fishermen. They're not used to cameras. Some of them are like hesitant to even tell their story because they're so old school, you know? I think being the way that I am, and I'm very comfortable being on camera, I'm able to sit down with them and actually, you know, I'll joke with them. I'll make little comments. I'll give them little bits of advice. But you remember our interview with Uncle Chuck, and he was sitting down and me and him started talking about our families and who we knew and who we're from. And then I was kind of leading the way when it came to the camera. And he even told me, he's like, man, he's like, you made this so much easier. He's like, I would have had a hard time doing this without you, you know? And that, I think, is what helps me on Eating Our Roots, from having years of experience, having a camera shoved in your face.
What does the recognition of the Emmy and what has that whole process felt like?
Yeah, it's huge, and we just didn't expect it. We were grateful, and we knew that we had something special, all of us. I think everybody that was involved in the show, and also our friends and family that watched the show with us, they all knew that it was something special. We just didn't know how far we could take that. Because it's like a child. Like, you always think your kid's good looking, and then you start bringing him out around other kids, and you're like, dang, my kid's not as good looking as these other kids, you know? So it's like the same thing. We're like, oh man, our show's great. Like, we thought our kid was really good looking. And then we started bringing it out, and we're like, wow, there's a lot of competition out there. But we were very happy with the results, obviously.
What can you tell us about season 2?
I can't tell that much. I mean, I'm meeting Kobe at 2:00 today to try to start really hammering things down. We do know that there is going to be a season 2. It's going to be on the same station. I think it's going to be a lot of very similar format. The show is designed a certain way to feature and star the farmers and ranchers, which makes every episode so different, you know, because of these characters. So because of the Emmy and stuff, we're hoping to be able to have a better budget. So now that we can create even more, we're going to extend our film time. Like, last year, there was days where we were going to one farm, going to the next, and then all in the same day. You know, when we filmed the kitchen scenes, it was done in like two or three days, like all eight episodes, you know? So this time we're going to be extending that and giving ourselves time to really focus on each spot. And I think that's going to give us a lot more B-rolls and shots and scenes that are just going to blow people's minds. Because honestly, the reason the show is so good is our cinematographer, like Gabe and then Dustin, are just, they make things that look regular in life look better on camera, which I've never understood. You know, like, how can something look better than what you see with your eyes, and then they make it look better? You know, I just wish they could do that with me when I'm on camera, because it never seems to translate onto camera. But everything else, like, they make things look, the way they shoot things and the way they see things, it's the reason why the show did so well. It's just, they did such a great job.
Yeah, no, and you can tell that, I mean, you are passionate about the team. It's a small team, and so anything like that, it has to be so tight-knit, and people need to be working in lockstep. You need to have that shared vision.
Yeah, that's the goal. The goal is to take this. Eating Our Roots isn't just about, like, you know, our Hawaii roots, and that's what we're focusing on right now, but the plan is for Eating Our Roots to be branching out and be able to do something, I guess, and feature farmers and ranchers all over. You know, that's really the goal.
So going back to Ippy's Pacific Voyage.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I got a lot of Portuguese in me. My mom's pure Italian. You know, it's like I got a lot of roots all over the world. So, you know, so yeah, going back to Ippy's Pacific Voyage. I like that.
Yeah, you couldn't have scripted that transition better about your personal roots and mixed blended identity, because we should also talk about your cookbook that will be coming out, Growing Up Hapa.
What an amazing transition. Growing Up Hapa, Hapa in Hawaiian meaning half Hawaiian, half something else, right? Growing Up Hapa was something that I've had this plan for, I mean, as long as I can remember. Like, that's always, ever since I wanted to do a cookbook, it's always been Growing Up Hapa. The idea is exactly like you said, because the way I grew up in, obviously born and raised in Waimea. My dad is Hawaiian. He had a Hawaiian plate lunch restaurant called the Kamuela Deli, one of the first plate lunch restaurants on the Big Island. And then my mom is Italian from New York and had an Italian restaurant called Salamini's. I went to a French culinary school called the Cordon Bleu when I graduated high school, came home, did a bunch of different things, was doing the Food Network stuff. Then I opened a restaurant called the Three Fat Pigs, which was a gastropub. And then I opened Ippy's Hawaiian Barbecue. So as you can see, that was one of the problems I had with Food Network when I was on the show, because they're all about a point of view. They're like, what is your POV? What is your point of view? And I tried to explain to them, I'm like, this is my point of view. Like, I am the product of the modern world, and I am a mixed breed of so many different cultures that this is what I do now. Like, I want to respect and cook what my mom taught me. I want to respect and cook what my dad taught me. I'm more than just one cuisine. And I think a lot of people from Hawaii, especially a lot of chefs from Hawaii, understand this, because our food culture is so blended. I mean, that's what Hawaiian plate lunch is. It's a blend of all these cultures. So, you know, if you grew up in a Mexican family, like my wife, you're mostly growing up eating Mexican food. You know, if you're in an Italian family, you're mostly eating Italian food. If you grew up in a Hawaiian family, you're eating Chinese, Portuguese, Filipino, Korean, a little bit of Hawaiian. You know, you're just, it's all over the place here. And so with Growing Up Hapa, I really wanted to showcase that. And also, I have a little bit of insight because I was born in the restaurant industry. You know, I was raised in the restaurant industry. I grew up, and that's what it's all about. Like, every chapter, so the first chapter is the Kamuela Deli with stories and recipes from my dad's restaurant. Second chapter, Salamini, stories and recipes from my mom's Ippy Swine Barbecue, the Three Fat Pigs. So it was hard because I know that when you get a cookbook, usually there's a theme, right? You buy an Italian cookbook, you buy a grilling cookbook, you buy, you know, whatever, a dessert cookbook. So there's usually a theme. So it was a little more difficult with being nervous that people were gonna, you know, not understand what the book was about. But that's who I am. And it really is. It's like, I am this mixed, we call them poi dogs here. Like, I am one of those, you know? So I really wanted to give back and show respect. And the stories are amazing. That's why I talk about it not just being a cookbook, because there's so much more to this book than just the recipes. Each chapter is filled with stories about opening the restaurants, what it was like when I was little, like the first memory I have of my parents when they first got the Kamuela Deli And me and my brother were little kids in the car, and it was during Christmas, and they told us, oh, you're not going to be able to get any Christmas gifts this year because we just had to take a loan out to buy this restaurant, you know. But we got to go into the restaurant. It was raining. We got to go in and eat anything we wanted. My parents were literally like, just put whatever you want, just eat whatever you want. And we grew up with not that much money, so that was a big deal for us. Like, that was a cool thing. And I have those stories woven into this, you know, about my mom when they opened her Italian restaurant and where I was and my emotions and the disaster of the Three Fat Pigs when I first opened that restaurant. Like, we talk about when the food critics are coming in and water and grease are coming up from the floor traps and there's a smell coming up from there. And nobody told me that the food critic was there until they were done with their meal. It shows the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know?
Yeah, it's memoir, it's food, it's very you.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Chef Ippi, for taking the time. And appreciate keep us posted about season two.
I definitely will. Oh, I'm sure we'll talk stories once that comes out, too.
And that was Chef Ippi Iona and HPR's Maddie Bender. They were talking about his regional Emmy Award-winning show, Eating Our Roots. Season two is expected this fall. Iona's upcoming cookbook, Growing Up Hapa in Hawaii, is available for presale and will be published in September. Now it's time to erupt the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we updated you about the eruption of Kilauea. Scientists predict episode 29 is likely to begin between July 17th and 20th. But massive lava fountains aren't just points of view for spectators and tourists. Scientists at the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory are tracking it with nearly 150 different monitoring instruments in and around the volcano. To check on these instruments, they wear specialized gear, including a kind of footwear that you don't often see in Hawaii. As a reminder, here's what field engineers sound like as they walk through fields of tephra, which is erupted material from a volcano. And we ask you to name the specialized footwear. The large surface area of these shoes help volcano scientists stay on top of those loose pumice stones. And the kind of shoe we're looking for, snowshoes. And congrats, Mike from Kaimuki, you got it right. That's today's quiz. If you'd like to share an idea for one, write to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, we're out of time, but up tomorrow, we hear from a Castle High School teacher whose ideas about the immigration crackdown reaches a national stage. We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our archive shows online on our website or by searching for The Conversation on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.